Shrink Wrap Radio Number 8, October 10, 2005. Interview with Stuart Kohler, attorney, private eye, and depth psychologist. Hello, everyone. This is David Van Nuys, a.k.a. Dr. Dave, coming to you from the beautiful wine country of Sonoma County, California, again. As you may know by now, our show revolves around interesting personalities in and around the world of psychology, and I really think you're going to enjoy today's interview. How often do you encounter someone who is an attorney, a private investigator, and a depth psychologist? I only know one. I don't know if it's his law training or what, but I found him to be an incredibly articulate speaker when it comes to abstract topics such as archetypes. So here's the interview with Stuart Kohler. My guest today is Stuart Kohler, who, among other things, has recently been a graduate student in depth psychology. Stuart, I'm always interested in how people find their way into psychology, and it seems to me that your path has been fairly unusual. I know you've been a lawyer and a private investigator. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that background and how it got you into psychology.
Well, actually, David, my interest in psychology developed well before I had the notion to go to law school, and life made me a private investigator. Interestingly enough, when I was a senior in high school, I was cutting class with my best friend for no doubt some unsavory purpose.
No doubt.
And I found two paperback books in the hallway of my school, which really informed my entire adult intellectual life. One of them was a book on existentialism, and the other one was The Portable Jung, edited by Joseph Campbell.
And you were how old at that point?
I was either 17 or 18.
Wow, yeah.
So when I found this book on Jung, I had heard the name in generalized conversation, usually coupled with Freud, and I started to read this stuff, and some of it was over my head at the time, but other parts of the volume spoke so incredibly directly to me. I remember having the thought at the time that, wow, this guy thinks just like me, except he's a lot smarter and he's done a lot more thinking about these kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. Now, somehow, though, you ended up going into law. What drew you into law?
Well, after my illustrious 5 to 6 year undergraduate college career.
In which you majored in what?
Well, I think I ended up having a psychology major, but at some point I spent 3.5 years in the physics department, and I studied a lot of philosophy. I actually began as a philosophy student, and then I felt in order to have a reasonable philosophical perspective in modern times, one needed to be familiar with physics.
Interesting,
so,
yeah.
So I started to study physics, and I got what I wanted out of it, which was primarily conceptual insight.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I really wasn't interested and possibly didn't have the aptitude to be a working physicist, but it was very enriching to my what I would now call a depth psychological approach to thinking.
Okay, and then somehow from there you gravitate towards law school.
Well, it's interesting, this notion of accident. I was visiting a friend who had taken the law school admissions test, and I had mistimed my visit, so he actually had to work when I arrived. So I sat down in his apartment, and I noticed the law school admissions test, and I took it, and I scored myself. And then I thought, hey, I can do this. And I had been politically active before then, and I decided that I would go to law school to try and become a tenants-only lawyer. I was a housing activist, organizing indigent tenants in New York City so that they could vindicate their own legal rights.
Okay. And then how did this lead into your what I gather is your current professional way of making your way in the world, which is being a private investigator?
Yes, that's right. Well, in law school, I was directed to a criminal law clinic, which I had mixed feelings about because of my own feelings about crime in our society. And that clinic that I was accepted into was taught by the now famous Barry Scheck. This was prior to the Innocence Project. And when I graduated from law school, I got a job investigating fraud and corruption, and then the Better Business Bureau. And after about 5 years of living in New York, I decided to move to the West Coast. And I took the first year off, and then I applied for a bunch of jobs, thinking that in 4 months I was going to quit anyway and take the bar. And I got hired as a supervisor in an investigative firm. And after a couple of months, I realized that perhaps that was a more suitable profession for me, especially in terms of my temperament. And that was in 1989.
Okay, now as I'm looking at you now, you're in a T-shirt, yes, shorts. You don't look like you're packing a gun. I gather it's not that kind of TV image of the private investigator.
No, I'm often confronted with the B-novel and B-movie stereotype, you might say. The type of stuff that I do is primarily in two areas. Workplace civil rights, where I work on behalf of plaintiffs only, and I work primarily with a nationally prominent civil rights attorney, Philip Kay, in San Francisco. And historically, I've done a great deal of criminal defense. In other words, somebody gets arrested for a crime, they hire an attorney, and the attorney hires me to either test the evidence of the prosecution for validity and firmness, or to develop our own evidence. And those are the two areas that I work in. So, in some ways, I'm a white-collar worker, the part of my work that involves computers and databases and that sort of thing. And the other part, which corresponds, of course, to another part of my personality, is the person who goes out on the streets in all of society's poorest neighborhoods and digs up information about people with very unusual nicknames.
Okay. And so then there must be another part that draws you into a graduate program in depth psychology. So tell us, how did that evolve?
Let's see. I'll try and pretend like I really understand this.
Okay.
I can tell you that after I graduated from college in 1983, I actually applied to the Jung Institute in New York for the Jung Institute training. And I was told I was an excellent candidate, except that I had no personal analysis. So I should say that the seed of this was planted, interestingly enough, 20 years prior to my admission to Sonoma State. So then we would flash back about 2.5 years. I received a letter in the mail telling me about a program at Sonoma State. It had been something that I was looking into for a while, but I hadn't found the right fit. And I came up here and I heard Dr. Laura McCabe make a presentation. And I knew instantly, not just intellectually, but somatically in my body, that this was a program that was not simply academic. This was about inner work, essentially. And I dropped everything, applied to the program, and was accepted, and here we are.
Okay. And I know that part of the core of that work of the program and in your personal work, a lot of it revolves around the writings of Carl Jung, who
yes,
you already alluded to. I wonder if you can put your finger on just what it is about Jung's work that speaks to you in particular.
Well, this harkens back to, if you recall, how I first encountered Jung. There was an immediate sense that this fellow organized his thoughts and his feelings and came to an understanding about those aspects of ourselves in the same way that I can relate to. Some of it is a vocabulary choice. You know, it's interesting, in answering this question, I have to look into the broader notion of what it is that moves any of us. Some of it may be contingent on word choice, the way of relating ideas. I think Jung tied things in for me in a way that nobody else had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a very important aspect of that is relating the personal to the impersonal. Because anybody who's paid attention to this sort of thing and given it some thought is struck by the interesting relationship between the individual life, personal intent and determinism, and forces that are clearly bigger than individuals.
Yeah. Are you talking specifically about synchronicity now, or
well,
or transpersonal ideas?
Yes, I am. And I think that synchronicity is certainly a really important area of, as you say, transpersonal ideas. Synchronicity is just one type. The mythological perspective, the idea that something which is so intimately personal to an individual, personal circumstance, work, romantic, self-relation, these things are so intimately personal to each of us, and yet there are historical precedents that deal with the same situations, mm-hmm. and I emphasize mm-hmm. situations, not the same particularities.
Right.
And this is really an appropriate segue into what Jung talks about as archetypes or the archetypal world.
Yes, I wanted to move into that because I know that in your graduate work you've been particularly interested in archetypes. And the whole notion of the archetype can be a slippery concept for people to get their minds around. So how would you explain the idea of archetype to someone who's not steeped in Jungian psychology? I know that's a bit of a challenge, but I'll put you on the spot.
That's okay, because Jung himself never really gave a great definition, but I can say this much. Archetypes are kind of structural forms of experience. They're not the experience themselves, but they're the unseen part of experiences that inform those experiences. Let me give a practical sort of analogy. Where one is out in a sailboat, and all of a sudden the sail starts to billow. In other words, the sail is filled with wind. Now, we don't see the wind, but we know it's there because the sail is billowing. And at the same time, we wouldn't say that that the wind is the sail.
Right.
So bringing that back to the archetype idea, the archetype would be the wind. The sail would be the particular experience. Giving a concrete example. First thing I can conjure up. Take a young boy, or anybody really, on the African continent. They're experiencing some confusion in their life, let's say, or some uncertainty. They have a dream that they're in the middle of a wildebeest stampede. A person in our society may be experiencing what are the same emotions and may have a dream that they're in midtown Manhattan amidst a sea of screaming cars. Well, it's the same underlying experience of personal disorganization,
okay.
but it's taken on a cultural form.
Okay. And I know there are a number of sort of recognized, well-known archetypes in the literature, such as the trickster archetype, the great mother, the hero,
yes.
And there are a number of others that have been articulated. And one that I know that you've devoted some study to is the archetypal image of Hermes. Maybe you can give us some background on that.
Yes, that's correct. I've been totally smitten by Hermes. Like many people who are familiar with mythology, I had always known Hermes as being the messenger god. Hermes makes appearances in the Iliad and the Odyssey and various other Greek writings, again, as the messenger of the underworld, the messenger between Olympus and the underworld and the winged god and that sort of thing. About two and a half years ago, I started to read more about Hermes, and I was just, in the vernacular, blown away. Hermes, historically, is a figure that goes back thousands of years before the Greeks. The now deceased, I think she's an archaeologist or anthropologist, Maria Gumboutas, talks about images of Hermes going back 4 or 5 millennium B.C. So this figure of Hermes started out as a phallic statue or an agrarian god, and over history evolved in a way that Jung might refer to as individuation, and that is the actualization of one's full potential. So the historical trajectory of Hermes is one that goes from being a stone statue or stones as boundary markers in agricultural real estate to the Greek Hermes, which now is an anthropomorphic form that sort of tricks his way into being the 12th god on Mount Olympus, because Hermes was not originally one of the Olympians. And then if we follow Hermes up through the Middle Ages into modern times, Hermes becomes a figure in alchemy that is the consummate figure. Hermes is both the process of individuation, of self-actualization, and also the goal of self-actualization. So taken across the broad sweep of history, Hermes is an incredible role model for individuation. This figure that starts out being a chunk of rock and ends up being the goal of self-actualization. And there are many other aspects of Hermes, the messenger between, the metaphor of Hermes being the messenger between the gods and the underworld is a metaphor for us who are interested in depth psychology and inner work, for the entering into healthy relations between the conscious and unconscious. I could go on and on.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you went there specifically, because that was a question I wanted to ask you, was, you know, what is that a metaphor for, shuttling between the Olympian gods and the underworld? And you're saying that's a metaphor for some psychic process within ourselves?
Yes, yeah, certainly that's the way I embrace the idea. We've all experienced that the boundary between our own consciousness and our own unconsciousness is a fluid boundary. Things that we're aware of today, we're not aware of tomorrow, and vice versa. And we may become reaware of them the next day. So there's a fluidity involved. And the ability of Hermes to go from the above world to the underworld, to me, is an example of that fluidity. And from the mythological Hermes, we know that Hermes has remarkable speed. And to me, that captures how the unconscious or the conscious can present itself in a moment, in a quick moment. And there are other aspects of Hermes. Hermes, and this is intimately related to the relationship between the conscious and the unconscious. By being a boundary marker way back when, Hermes, without a boundary, you don't have separate domains. And without separate domains, there's no communication. So that old expression, good fences make good neighbors, has a deeper truth, and that is fences make neighbors. And from the psychological perspective, Hermes creates boundaries only to transgress them. So Hermes both defines the distinction between the conscious and the unconscious, and then also, in the same breath, creates a conduit between the two.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
Now, this image of Hermes, I mean, trying to get hold of this, somehow that the image of Hermes, the metaphor of Hermes, this archetype becomes an organizing principle in your own life as you study the history of the archetype and so on. Is that the case?
It is certainly the case. And because of the nature of depth work, it's sometimes hard for me to even verbalize this, because it's connected so much with my own inner processes, which are sometimes elusive. But in Hermes, see, it's interesting, the evolution of my understanding of Hermes in relation to myself, of course, mirrors my own ability to delve into and constructively engage my own unconscious.
Okay.
So when I first started to work with Hermes, I was taken in by what I could call Hermes' descriptive powers in relation to my life. For example, as a private investigator, I am acting as a messenger between two worlds. I am going out into the field and I'm getting information, oftentimes from people that are at the very underbelly of our society. So I'm going into the underworld, you might say, and certainly my work in the criminal field, as well as the civil field, has been, from one perspective, an adventure into the shadow world, mm-hmm. of our society. And what I'm doing is I'm going into that underworld, and then I'm bringing that back to some nice attorney,
yeah.
in a suit and tie,
uh-huh.
in a middle or upper middle class environment, with an entirely different sort of under education and background. And so that's a hermetic aspect.
Yeah, that's a great example,
yes.
of shuttling between two worlds. And Hermes has a trickster element too, right?
Yes.
And I think you have a bit of that?
So I'm told. Now, I mentioned to you earlier that there is an evolution in my understanding of Hermes. Now, initially when I encountered the trickster element, I thought, oh, isn't this terrific? This is me, aren't I slick?
Yeah.
And it's nice to have those abilities. I'm not going to be self-denigrating. It's nice to have those. But the deeper I came to understand Hermes internally, I saw, well, I'm not only a trickster in the world, but sometimes internally in dealing with myself, I'm a trickster. And that becomes much more problematic. That's nothing to brag about. Mm-hmm. It means that I'm capable of kidding myself about mm-hmm. things.
Self-deception.
Self-deception. Yeah. The difficulty of nailing down, for example, what the right thing for me to do or what the right aspect of my personality is to bring to bear in this particular instance. It's wonderful that the trickster can generate all these possibilities, but what's right in a situation?
You're right, right.
And there are many, many other aspects of Hermes that I've seen. I do a lot of traveling internationally and in this country. And Hermes, we learn in the Odyssey, is the protector of travelers. Mm-hmm. And something I didn't mention earlier, but up until the time I entered law school in the mid-80s, I hitchhiked about 35,000 miles in this country and Canada. And not only did I have Hermes protection, I never had a bad experience, but hitchhiking bears a great similarity and was sort of a foundational activity for me for investigation. There's this term that we speak of in depth psychology, liminality. The liminal phase is a stage, sometimes it's been called the betwixt and the between, the neither here nor there. It's a stage in external events or in internal events that's in between two solid states, mm-hmm. middle age.
When you're crossing that boundary between yes. two places.
A middle age has been described as a liminal state because you're not young. There's certain things that you can't do that you yep. used to do, but you're also not old. There's a lot of things you can do.
Right.
So my hitchhiking, standing on the side of the road is a perfect liminal activity, as is standing at the door of an apartment in a housing project where you've gone unannounced.
Yes.
There's this uncertainty that you're faced, and
right.
you're neither here nor there.
Hitchhiking, it seems to me, is also a very archetypal image or experience of being on the road. You know, we've got the Jack Kerouac yes. novel of On the Road, and Joseph Campbell, of course, in Hero with a Thousand Faces, really lays out a whole system of mythological references to this idea of being on the road.
Yes, I agree. It's an incredibly rich, it's a rich metaphor and it's a rich actuality.
Yes.
And again, I'm going to tie this back into liminality because it's really so much about who I believe I am. Liminality, because all of the solid states, the states that we're in between, have essentially liquefied, can be a time of great uncertainty, but because of that, it's also a time of great potentiality. And that's one of the areas that I identify with Hermes. And from a Jungian typological perspective, I'm an intuitive. So an intuitive, when they look at a situation or a circumstance, is not so much interested in what it is as what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
What are the possibilities of
mm-hmm.
this?
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Wait, what are some of the tools that you've used to explore this Hermes concept within yourself? You've talked about the need to go down deep within and the danger of tricking yourself and so on. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if there are specific tools such as writing or other imaginative type exercises that have worked for you as you've explored this in your own life.
That's a great question. I wish I had a greater success to relate to you.
Yeah.
I can tell you that I've started to do some artwork, which sometimes does and sometimes doesn't relate to hermetic qualities. But I mention it because the Hermes energy can be incredibly cerebral. And that legendary speed of Hermes, as it's depicted in the myth, on the internal side, is itself the trickery. So at times I've tried to work with Hermes physically because I've always been very physical and very athletic. I recall humorously one time trying to do some sort of inner meditation on Hermes while I was running. And I nearly tripped several times. And then I thought, this guy Hermes is too fast for me.
Yeah.
So what I've tried to do is I've tried to essentially trick myself into an awareness of the trickster, which is to calm myself down first.
Okay.
And in some sort of meditative practice, whether it be artwork or sitting, and then to try and ground some of the qualities of Hermes in myself. And by that, I mean to get beyond the understanding of Hermes that corresponds to my persona. Sure, I like to think of myself as a person that can do certain things in the world and that has certain qualities and that has had the good fortune of being protected when traveling and on the road. But again, there are these internal aspects of Hermes. What are the boundaries inside that need to be transgressed vis-a-vis becoming more aware of things? So that's been my approach.
So I gather you're not on a trajectory to become a professional psychologist per se. So I'm wondering, how will this work in depth psychology, your work with Hermes, how do you see it informing your future?
Okay. Good. Another good question. Well, some of this is going to be a purely personal matter in terms of what I've gotten out of the program, what I've gotten out of my own work. It's just something that I bring to everyday life now, to understand that it's nice to have an operable intellect, but that real understanding has to be grounded. And so I try and do that. In a more public way of answering this, or as my education is going to bear on my life in public, I would like to... I'm working on an article that I hope to get published. I'm working on a thesis. What I hope to do to maintain my connection to the world of ideas and people connected to depth psychology is to muster up the organization and courage to present at one or two conferences each year and to publish a little bit.
I can definitely see you doing that, having heard you speak. To wrap things up, are there any readings that you would recommend for someone who wants to find out more about the sorts of things that we've just been talking about?
Well, you know, I would recommend sort of a two-pronged approach for people. I think that reading mythology is incredibly enjoyable. It's very manageable for many people's lives because you can sit down and read a 10-page myth, or you can read something like the Odyssey and, you know, spend a week or two reading some really nice literature. And to temper that, or to bring something else to that, I would think that... maybe one of Jung's writings. He has a book that he put out in 1959 called Man and His Symbols, which has some writing by Jungians.
Right.
Some people find the Jungians, people like Marie-Louise von Franz and...
Joseph Henderson.
Edward Edinger. And these folks, to actually be more lucid. Jung has a very locatory, can you say that word, way of writing that some people find to be a put-off. So I would suggest maybe reading Man and His Symbols or reading Marie-Louise von Franz, and then maybe trying to apply that to a situation in your life, trying to look at what are some impersonal elements in one's own circumstances. I know that might be a little daunting for people, but once you pick up something and read something, it will speak to you or it won't. It's not for everybody.
Yeah. And when you recommend that people read mythology, I mean, when I was exposed to mythology as a kid, you know, those were just sort of quaint old stories from the past.
Yes.
I gather you're advocating a different attitude in the reading of a myth.
Yes. Thank you for asking that question, because as I answered it before, I realized I left something out. The thing about myths... or they tap into something that's universal. There's a reason why we're still telling and repeating and reconfiguring myths that have been around for thousands of years. It's not an accident. It's not just because that's all academia wants to do. There are certain universal themes. You mentioned some of them before, the mother. You mentioned it as a mother archetype. We all have an idea about a mother that transcends our actual mother. We all have this idea that a mother should be nurturing, should be supportive, should be somebody that's wise, that we can consult in a difficult time. We have other archetypes corresponding with puberty, marriage, death, these are all transition stages in life. This is what mythology presents to us. And one of the interesting things about mythology is it doesn't present it as an abstraction. It presents it as it bears upon individual lives. And something that I think is important for all of us to understand and to come to terms with is that we can be as abstract as we want in considering mythological and archetypal themes, but it's important to recognize that life occurs in individual forms. And so this material all needs to be wrestled down into individual lives, and that's why I suggest mythology.
Okay, so when I read a myth, I'm reading about a story about specific individuals, but then I need to bring that back somehow to, well, how does this maybe represent a pattern in my own life?
Yes, that's right. And the way that one does that is to recognize and tap into the broader themes. Many of these myths talk about people like the hero myth that you alluded to before. They talk about people leaving their home, leaving their society, going out and having a great adventure and bringing it back. Well, we've all had to do that in some fashion. Maybe not as dramatic as Odysseus, who was wandering for 10 years and came back to find a bunch of men trying to marry his wife. Maybe we've had to leave a community, maybe we've had to leave a lifestyle, maybe we've had to leave a person, a circumstance, and go out and try something new, and then eventually integrate that back into our lives. And that's the sort of thing that one who has had a basic familiarity with some depth psychology ideas, who reads a myth, you can see those patterns, and then you can say, okay, well, I didn't sail the Mediterranean for 10 years, but I moved out west from New York. And when I moved out here, I didn't have a career, and now I do. And how does that relate to this person that I've been all along?
Okay, Stuart Kohler, thank you very much for this interview. That's a great place for us to wrap it up.
Okay, thank you for having me, David. It's been a real pleasure, and it's a great program you have. I've listened to many of them.
Great, thank you.
Well, that's our interview. I sure hope you enjoyed it. By the way, I'm aware that so far all of the interviews have featured men, but don't despair. I have some terrific women lined up, starting hopefully with the very next show. And I want to tell you, today is a red letter day in two respects. First, we finally got our first piece of listener feedback. JR sent us an email saying, "Please keep the show up. I love it, and I'm looking forward to future episodes. Do you know if there are any other psychology-oriented podcasts? I love your show, but if there are others, then I won't have to always be waiting for your newest episode." Well, I can't tell you how much this warms Dr. Dave's heart to get this feedback. And you will find out about one other show in the promo that I'll be playing at the end of the session. We'd love to get more listener feedback. Send your emails or your MP3 voicemails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can catch us on Skype at ShrinkPod, or leave voicemail on Gizmo Project for ShrinkPod. Now, Gizmo Project is free software that you can download, just like Skype is free software that you can download, and they allow you to make free phone calls all over the country, all over the world, for free to anybody else who has that same software installed. The second reason this is a red letter day is Yahoo has announced that it will be including podcasts in its directory. Better yet, a friend has informed me that a search in their new podcast directory using the keyword psychology brings up Shrink Wrap Radio. Well, that's today's show. If you enjoy Shrink Wrap Radio, I think you will also enjoy Insight Works at www.insightworks.com. It's a husband and wife team, Robin and Suzanne Maiden. They have a depth psychology podcast out of Atlanta, and I think they provide good info and they speak from their hearts. Please take a listen to the Insight Works promo, which will follow immediately after our closing theme music.
Hi, I'm Robin.
And I'm Suzanne.
We are InsightWorks.com. That's InsightWorks.com.
Hey, it's the beginning of the month, so please vote for us at Podcast Alley.
Honey, this is a promo, not a regular show. We're supposed to tell people what we do.
Oh, yeah. But you know what? After they hear what we do, they're going to want to vote for us. Because we talk about everyday things.
And not so everyday things.
Well, we'd also talk about current events and what's in the news.
And what motivates people to do what they do.
Well, but I think what it's important to know is that we put a different spin on everyday events.
Well, we talk about things that we think are common to everyone.
Things like grief, relationships, and emotional wounds. We look through the lens of depth psychology.
And if you don't know what depth psychology is, well, join us at InsightWorks.com. That's InsightWorks.com.
So, if you're ready to get real, if you're ready to get relevant, then you're ready to get with Robin and Suzanne at InsightWorks.com. Bye for now. That's a wrap.